is Music on the Rocks with Chris Castellanos. I've got a great guest with me today. She is an amazing horn player. Michelle Baker is with me. She was second horn with the Met for a long time. You had quite the tenure with the orchestra, which brings me to why I'm drinking my drink called 10-Year Vodka. So,
nice. Yeah. I appreciate the tribute.
So, Michelle, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Excellent.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, of course. Yeah. That's my pleasure. So I always start off these episodes with what everybody's drinking. And of course, not everybody has to drink. Alcohol is the thing. I mean, I'm not forcing that on anybody, of course. I'd be a terrible person if I did. But, yeah, so like I said, I'm having a 10-year vodka and soda. And what are you having?
Herbal iced tea.
In
this nice glass that my student's parents bought for me.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you for look that. Actually, that's really good. All right. So how's everything been going with you?
It's good. I'm the chair of the brass department at Manhattan School. So the end of the school year, I had to quickly learn a lot of things about, you know, my computer and how to run recitals and, you know, organize things online, and, you know, moderate success. I had a lot of help, and the students are super creative and were helpful to me. And so this summer I'm trying to get a little bit more familiar with my computer, because I'm still going to be online starting in the fall, because my husband has an immune system issue. So we don't really go out much, and but not much. And we did take a road trip actually to go see my parents in Texas. But we were super careful and quarantined and all that stuff. But basically we stay home and we love our house. And as he just said today, we still love each other. So, you know, we're really lucky.
The reassurance is always good.
And we've been married for 30 years. So that's kind of awesome that we can still say that.
That's so awesome.
Yeah. So, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, I think I was practicing a lot and teaching a lot and doing a lot of studio classes. When we went to Texas, I, you know, kind of slacked off a little bit because I wanted to spend time with my parents and not be spending time in the practice room. So since I've come back, it's a little slow getting back, but I'm getting back into it. I'm teaching and we have studio class. Last week we had two in 1 week. So my kids are super eager and it's inspiring to me, you know, how much they want to do it during this time.
Right, for sure. A lot of us, when this thing first started, we were kind of thinking this will be done in a couple of weeks or a month or something. So we're kind of using it as vacation time, like, oh, I'll do this or I'll do that. And then as things kind of progressed, it's like, oh boy, I got to figure stuff out. And although I don't teach very often, except for doing master classes and stuff on the road, which was automatically donezo after that. But for you and for a lot of my professor friends, it's you guys had to like figure out a whole new way to not only teach and keep everything going, but to have the students be able to do recitals and finish projects and finish juries and just all kinds of stuff. So that must have been a really quick learning curve.
Yeah, it was difficult for me because I'm not a tech type person. But like I said, I had a lot of help and you know, we did, everyone played a recital that was supposed to, and some of them did it live and some of them recorded on YouTube, and then we all met. That was actually kind of cool. So we would have the recital, we all met and we'd play the YouTube thing. Some people would go off and listen to the clip because it sounded better, and then they come back and we, you know, chatted and had like the after party or whatever online. And, you know, it was kind of nice, you know, to have that much, like all the brass faculty were at, you know, so-and-so's recital. And that doesn't normally happen in real life, you know?
Right. Yeah, of course.
So that was nice.
So I know that you're on faculty over at Manhattan. Now you're also at a number of other places also, right?
Just one other place now, Montclair State University.
Okay.
That's a mile from my house. Oh, nice. And it has a pretty thriving music department there. So, and I have a lot of friends who work there and teach there. And so I enjoy it. I enjoy being there, and have two kids there, and the rest are at Manhattan School. So,
okay, cool.
And then, you know, like I said, I'm chair of the brass department. So that's a big chunk of time, which I enjoy.
Right. I've got a lot of friends who've gone to school over there, and they just love it. They have the best time.
I love it too. I just can't wait for things to get back to normal so we can all be there. Yeah.
For sure. When did you start playing the horn?
I was 12, sixth grade. That's when band, you know, started. I grew up in Texas, and so that's when band started. I had already been playing piano for about 6 years, I think. And then, yeah, I wanted to play the flute. I apologize to all the people who have heard this story 1,000 times on other podcasts and interviews. You haven't heard it. Okay, I'll just tell you. So I wanted to play the flute because all my friends are playing the flute. And I was very little then. And my hand wouldn't reach an octave on the piano. So they said, you can't reach, you know, the octave key or whatever it is. And so you can't play it. But in reality, they really wanted me to play the horn because we had done like a matching pitches test or something. And I, you know, did better than other people, I guess. And so they decided that I should play the horn. So I had to walk to school. And like I said, I was a little bit small at that point. And I was worried about carrying the horn case and, you know, banging up my legs and whatever. And because they didn't have backpacks back then.
Right.
Too bad. But anyway, my band director, Jack Ferris is his name, if he happens to see this, he tricked me. He played the horn and I loved the sound and he sounded beautiful. And I said, but I'm worried about walking to school. And he said, just go over there and pick up the case. You know, you'll see it's not that heavy. So I picked it up and I was like, okay, I'll play it. And it turns out the case was empty. I owe him everything, but you know, it's just kind of funny that he had to trick me into picking the horn.
I remember those hard cases. I used to ride my bike to lessons and I'd have the case on one of the handlebars, one of the sides, and I ate it every 2 months.
That's funny.
But were you into it right away, or did you kind of have to, like, you know, gradually get into it? Or
I think I was into it, yeah. I have 5 older brothers, and they're all into sports and, you know, whatnot, and I really wasn't. I mean, I love sports. I'm huge Yankee fan, watch baseball all the time. It's taping right now while we're meeting. And my husband and I, when the Yankees are live, have been to many, many games and traveled to Boston to see them there and stuff. Anyway, but I just never did really play sports. And so I needed a thing, you know, that I did that wasn't what they did. And then I also played organ, because I played organ at my church. So I was practicing all the time while they were outside doing sports.
Oh, wow. So do you think that the organ playing and the piano playing helped you along with the horn playing? I mean, it must really helped with the reading part and everything.
Yeah, reading for sure. But also I think my ear, you know, got better. I mean, don't you find that? Like people who play piano, they tend to have decent ear.
Yeah, they've got like a better relationship with intervals and
yeah,
stuff, it seems. Yeah. On the horn is everything, as we know.
That's so, right.
Okay, well, that's cool. So you were into it and naturally really just dug playing the instrument. Well, you grew up in Texas, you were saying.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's really competitive there when you're growing up.
It is.
Get into the All-State and all that stuff.
I remember throwing a big fit because I think I got second chair or something in All-State. And I just threw a fit and I cried and carried on. It was insane. I think that was my senior year. Or maybe it was even like fourth place or fourth chair or something. I forget. But I was upset that I didn't get first. And, you know, looking back, I was like, you idiot. It's not that important.
I know. I have a daughter who's 14, and it's like every little thing that happens right now is just like the be all end all, you know what I mean? And I remember that too. I was pretty competitive also by the end of high school. At the beginning of high school, I didn't really care. I was kind of a slacker, but.
I think you're quite a bit younger than me, aren't you? How old are you?
I don't think I'm that much younger than you. I'm 41. about to be 42. So
I'm 15 years older than you.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Why do you look younger than me?
That's not true. Yeah. You're nice.
Start to drink iced tea instead. When you went into college, where did you decide to go? And why did you decide to go there?
Well, I had studied with the Fourth Horn and the Houston Symphony, I think starting my junior year in high school. And because it wasn't that far to Houston from where I lived. And then he taught at University of Houston. So he said, come here. So I did. And that way I lived at home for 1 year. I was definitely mama and daddy's girl. Didn't want to leave my house. And so I studied with Mr. Andrus for, Jay Andrus for, let's see, 2 years. And then Julie Landsman came to the University of Houston.
Okay.
And she was already playing in Houston Symphony, but she started teaching at U of H. And so I studied with her for my junior year. And then she left because she got the Met. And I studied with Nancy Goodearl, who's the third horn, still the third horn in Houston Symphony. I saw her on they did a live stream concert the other night, the Houston Symphony Brass. Anyway, so I studied with her my senior year, and, you know, Julie on the side whenever she was around or whatever. We didn't have video stuff back then, but we were definitely in touch. And she said, when she got the job at Juilliard, she said, come. No, wait, I'm messing the story up. She wasn't at Juilliard yet. She just said, come to New York and study with me and whatever. And I had wanted to study with James Chambers at Juilliard because that was her teacher. And I adored the record James Chambers Plays the Horn. I don't know if you've heard this. If you haven't, you need to.
Oh, yeah. I have, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And people listening, make sure you check it out. It's kind of awesome. And so anyway, I decided to go to Juilliard and study with Mr. Chambers and Julie on the side. And Mr. Chambers knew about me studying with her on the side. And so I did my master's in 1 year. As the last year you could do your master's in 1 year. And then my parents said, you got to get a job. Stay in school, get a job, or come home. So I didn't want to come home because I just started freelancing a little bit and, you know, getting pretty comfortable in New York. And so I started the professional studies, I think it's called, program that's for the second year at Juilliard, and got Jersey Symphony. So I quit school and went and played in Jersey.
Okay.
Awesome. So, yeah, but it wasn't a degree program. It's just professional studies. So.
Yeah. Nothing like a little ultimatum from the parents to.
Yeah, right. I mean, I would have probably loved being home too, but like I said, I was starting to get comfortable in New York and, you know, wanted to see what was there for me. So
being in New York for the length of time that you've been there, what are some of the fun freelance that you were doing?
Well, I think really kind of the first freelance stuff I started doing was the Philharmonic. Started calling me. There was a concerto competition the year I was at Juilliard that I won, and turns out it was the Philharmonic Horn Section that was judging. And so there was some need that came up, and they're like, you know, hey, what about that girl we heard, you know? So I got called to play there, and I did for about a year, I guess. Went on a couple tours and something like that. And then Jersey started to conflict, and you know how those things work. Okay. But then I actually did the most fun sort of outside stuff, although that was really fun playing with the Philharmonic. Once I got in the Met, started doing some movie soundtrack stuff and playing like with Michael Bublé and Sting. Oh. And you know, I love that stuff. So like when you do like Tears for Fears or whatever, that kind of stuff, I'm so excited because, you know, that's the kind of music that I love to listen to and would love to play.
Oh yeah, I love that kind of music. And Michael Bublé is actually one of my favorite guys. I gotta admit, I was a little bit of a hater when he came out because I've always loved crooners. I was born in Vegas and I've, you know, Rat Pack and all this stuff. And remember when he first came out, like his big thing was that he was like on a Starbucks commercial or something. That's like how he got really huge. And I was like, who's this Starbucks guy pretending to be a, you know? And then I like listened to him and his voice is amazing. And then you get to play with him and he's a really cool guy.
Yeah. Oh, you played with him too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. He's really cool.
He is.
Yeah. So I'm a fan.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. He was, you know, sometimes you play with those kind of people and they don't really want to have anything to do with us, you know, but he wanted to get to know everybody and chat and, you know, all that stuff. Exactly. It was cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so like, what's one of your favorite movie soundtracks that you've done?
Oh boy. Greatest Showman.
Oh, no way. Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That was really fun. And we all knew it was going to be something big. That song, This Is Me, actually heard it last night. My oldest grandchild turned 13, Sophie, and we had a little outdoor, you know, dinner thing for her birthday, a few of us, and she was playing soundtrack. She loves musicals, and that song came on. She's like, Noonie, this is your song. but when we were recording it, you know, we were all like singing it for days and, you know, this is going to be huge. And it is.
Yeah.
So I would have to say that one. And my family gets very excited that I'm playing for that one because they all love that movie. And,
yeah.
You know, my granddaughter loves it. So let's see, like True Grit.
Oh, I really like that one.
Yeah. The most fun things to play, just like sort of off the wall kind of movies.
Right.
I remember playing for a movie called Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which you probably never heard of.
I don't know that one, no.
Yeah, and I should have thought about this before I met with you. The guy committed suicide soon after that movie.
I know who you're talking about.
Starts with an A.
Oh, dang. Now we're both going to just go and scratching our heads now.
Anyway, look up Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. That guy, that music was fun. And that actually, funny story about that recording session, even though you didn't ask me to tell you a funny story, is that my stomach was growling a lot during the session. And of course it gets picked up on the mics and they would have to stop. And it was really embarrassing.
Loud enough to be caught on the mics.
Yes. And I had eaten and drank water and whatever, just for some reason it was growling. And it got to be pretty funny, I gotta say.
That's so funny. I've never heard of a take getting ruined by a growling stomach. That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty small group of people, so that's why.
Yeah, I love some of those movies. Like True Grit, I remember seeing that, and the girl on that, the young girl, just like blew me away. Like just her acting, I was like,
yeah.
I'm trying to think of like the style of music and the soundtrack of that one.
It was a lot of sort of dark chords, and you know, it wasn't like, you know, John Williams or anything like that.
Probably Western.
Nothing like that.
Okay. So we left off when you were playing in the Jersey Symphony. Now, where did you play after that?
The next job was the Met. So let's see, I played there in Jersey 3 years, 2 years on fourth horn, 1 year on third horn. Uh-huh. And then I won the 1 year position at the Met. And then took a leave from Jersey to do that 1 year. And then during that 1 year, I won the full-time position at the Met. You know, you had to take
the same position,
yeah. Okay. The international audition, you know. The first one was maybe, I don't know, 25 people, maybe less, that showed up for that 1 year position. It was all invitee only. And I got invited because Julie invited me. And it's who you know? I mean, it was behind a screen, so they didn't know it was me. But I mean, just the fact that I was there is due to her. That's and cool. Then, during that year, I had the international audition where, you know, everybody sends tapes and whatever. But I got to advance to the semis because I was playing there, which was nice.
Okay.
And thank God I won that job. And 27 years later, I retired.
What a career. 27 I mean, and that's a much different playing than playing in an orchestra. I mean, when you're playing operas every night, a full opera, and it's just like, I mean, it's a whole different world, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it took some figuring out, like, how to, the endurance part of it, especially the ring cycle and, you know, the big ones. We had our little traditions, like second intermission of a 6-hour opera, everybody takes Advil, you know. This huge bottle of Advil in my locker, and I was just like, okay, everybody go to Michelle's locker, you know. But it was, you know, really, really fun, and you know, such a great group of people. And yeah, I miss it for sure. I mean, I retired mainly because of family. I have 4 grandkids that up until the pandemic I was helping take care of. Wow. And driving to school and, you know, spending a day with the youngest one and whatever, walking to school, picking up from school. Yeah. And that's what I wanted to do, you know, and there were so many times when I couldn't because I had to go to work or, you know, whatever. So, so I was happy to be able to retire. We have the early retirement, the rule of 80, which I can't begin to explain to you, I don't think. Let me think. I think it's the age you are plus your years of service. That's what it is. So I was 53 and had been there 27 years. So when that equals 80, then you can retire.
Really?
Yeah. So I think they still have it. Well, I mean, they're not working right now, but when they're back, I think it's still in the contract.
Well, what if you start playing when you're pretty young, though? I mean, it's like, well, who won your job? Isn't it? What's his name?
Hugo. Yeah. Hugo. Yeah.
I mean, he's pretty young. So for him to get to 80, he's going to have to play in the orchestra for like 50 years.
Well, he can retire when he's 65 or whatever, but if you want to retire early. Julie also did rule of 80. I felt like it was time, you know, because of my grandkids, but also when I was thinking about it, I looked at like the last week of that season, what it was going to be. And it was Rose and Cavalier and Fidelio. It's a good way to go out.
Yeah, especially for a second horn. Also,
yeah. So that's, I just thought that was like my sign that, you know, this is the time. But, you know, I miss it. I just recently watched, they had a recital. Jonas Kaufman did a recital on the Met website. And they had some recordings, pre-recorded arias from, you know, operas that they've done and whatever. And I found myself getting really emotional, just missing, you know, the sound of the orchestra. I've been back there so many times to watch operas and go to their concerts in Carnegie, and I miss it. You know, it's great people, great music, you know, just a nice feeling overall there. And I've subbed there quite a bit actually since I left. Oh, okay. Which is fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can only imagine after putting that amount of time into a job and then just not being there or not doing it or not having your name part of that seat anymore.
Yeah.
A difficult thing. But that job, not only, I was going to say, when you were talking about Advil and the fatigue and stuff of playing a 6-hour opera, I mean, not only is it fatigue playing, but I mean, just mentally, it's got to be big time because that's much longer than the average concert, like 3 times.
Yeah.
It's like you're playing a triple every night or so.
That's right. I was lucky because where I sat most of the time, I could see the stage.
Oh.
So I watched the show while I was playing. I mean, when it wasn't, you know, like Traviata or La Boheme or something, I could play in my sleep. You know, I could turn and watch the show and you know, it kept me interested and focused. And
right.
Yeah, I mean, if you ask my colleagues, like, that, they were always commenting on how focused I seemed, but it was a conscious effort, you know, to not like chat too much because then I get distracted, you know, or right. Like if there's a big chunk of rest, sometimes people will leave the pit, and sometimes I did, but for the most part I stayed in the pit just because it was distracting. You know, go out, you have a conversation, you have to come back in and play some hard lick, and it was hard for me to, like, you know, get back in the game. So right. I just stayed in the pit and stayed in the game as much as I could. Of course there were days that it didn't work in all those years, all those performances, but I tried. And yeah, I mean, it was definitely work at first to make myself do that, you know, like this isn't social time right now, you know, then we have 30, 40 minutes off in the intermission and we all go to the cafeteria and hang out. And, you know, it's like a big family. Yeah. So, yeah. So it was, like I said, I miss it, as you can tell, probably how I'm speaking about it. Yeah. And I feel terrible that they're not working right now.
Yeah. It's so difficult for everybody right now. I mean, just seeing my Broadway friends and my friends in orchestras and my touring friends.
Yeah, right.
It's, and nobody knows what's going on or what's going to come back. Or so it's, I guess it's a good time to be retired, I suppose. But
I am blessed.
But yeah. Some people are thinking more on the gloom and doom side of things. Some people are more on the bright side of things. I tend to lean more towards the bright side all the time, or else I'd drive myself nuts, you know.
Yeah.
Especially being a touring musician, and it's like you even say the word airplane and it's a bad word right now, or you know,
true.
And it's like, oh, so when's the next time I'm gonna work? I don't know. Concert halls have to come back first, and then they have to decide who's gonna. So, but. Anyway, back to what you were talking about, what's the preparation like for going into the full opera cycle like that?
Well, the rumor is that it takes 7 years of playing at the Met until you know all the standard rep. I don't know if that's a fact, but that's what people say. Because you know, get through the cycle of Bohème 1 year, Traviata the next, you know, that kind of thing. So then you get those under your belt and you feel a little bit more comfortable. But at first it's a lot of cramming and studying and listening and, you know, trying to play through it so you know you have the chops to do it. And I mean, at the beginning, when I first started working at the Met, there Mr. Levine, Maestro Levine, was able to do however many rehearsals he wanted. Like they gave him carte blanche to do whatever he wanted. And I guess money was no object at that point. And so I kind of learned a lot of the shows on the job, you know, because we had a lot of rehearsals. But like my one of the first things I played was Rosenkavalier without a rehearsal. Because I came in in November because I had already agreed to do a Marlboro tour. Once I got the job, so I couldn't, and signed a contract, so I couldn't get out of that, and so I came late to the Met, and it was time to play Rosenkavalier. So, you know, that, if you look at the second horn part, I'm sure Ugo got a new part, but there's so many cues and, like, little tiny markings, you know, yeah. And that's just what I needed to be comfortable. I think there are other people, I can think of some other horn players who don't need that much, you know, detail. I just... That's what I need, you know, yeah. I need a lot of information to be comfortable and, you know who's playing what when and all that stuff.
It's funny, a lot of the best musicians that I see are the ones who write something in immediately. You read through everything once on a job and then you go and play it later that night. It's like, they're not making that mistake again, or they're not.
That's right.
A lot of times they didn't even make a mistake. It's like their mind kind of went, I almost made that mistake. I'm going to write it in.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, it's funny you say that because I play piano, as I mentioned, and I decided a long time ago I wasn't going to spend a whole lot of time practicing stuff for, I play at my church, stuff for church, like hours and hours like I would tend to do on my horn. You know, I needed to draw the line. So I do exactly what you said, like if I was, I almost played a B flat there instead of B natural, you know, like circle it or write in the accidental, you know,
right.
So all my piano music looks like that because I don't want to spend the time practicing. I'd rather work on, you know, something on the horn.
So your solo recordings are really nice. I mean, and it's
Thank
funny,
you.
It wasn't too long ago that I was actually listening to Hindemith, the alto.
Yeah. And I'm playing on alto horn.
I know, yeah, and that's what I'm going to ask you about. Did you have an alto horn before that? Or,
well,
many people have it, you know, it's unless you're playing like in a brass band or something like that.
Right, well, my husband, just until recently, was a conductor of a brass band, bandmaster of a brass band at our church. It's a English-style brass band, uh-huh. And he conducted it, I think, 30, 40 years, something like that. And he just recently stepped down and his son has taken over. which is cool. But yeah, so the alto horns in that band, and Dylan Music had, that's a shop in Woodbridge, New Jersey. They had alto horns there, and this opportunity came open for me. And Joe Anderer, who just retired as principal horn at the Met, he's also on that recording, on the French horn concerto. And so he knew my connection to the English brass band, and he asked if I wanted to do it. And so I asked Dylan, they lent me an alto horn. And I'm not playing an alto horn mouthpiece. There's an adapter.
Okay. And,
I can't make a sound on an alto horn mouthpiece.
that is a rough, I mean, I know some players who can like make that switch. I don't know. I just can't. Not
into
that.
not me. But that was really fun, a fun project, and I performed it a few times, and the pianist that I played with, David Korovar, is just amazing. And that was fun.
Yeah. I think also playing a regular horn mouthpiece, it just makes the alto horn sound a little bit broader. I don't know.
Yeah. I think you might be right.
Up is different, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, the intonation was a little weird, I think probably because the adapter. And then, you know, having to think in the opposite way, you know,
right. In
E flat, but ugh, anyway.
Well, your performance of that is so beautiful though. I mean,
Thank you. It
really showcases your musicality, I think.
Oh, you're so nice. Thank you.
When you're playing solo, as opposed to when you're playing under a conductor, do you prefer that kind of thing, or do you prefer?
No.
You prefer playing in.
I prefer playing in the pit. No, I mean, I have done it more recently for sure, you know, since I retired. Recital at school, recital at Roundtop Music Festival. Pardon me, it was my 20th year teaching there. So they did, they allowed me, the concert was called Carte Blanche to Michelle Baker. So I get to play whatever I wanted to play with, whoever I wanted to play with. And so that was fun. And sort of like masterclass thing where I might play a solo here, there, whatever. But no, it's not my comfort zone for sure.
That's a great name for a recital, by the way. I think I want to name all my recitals just Carte Blanche. I'm gonna just do whatever I want.
Actually, if you Google Carte Blanche to Michelle Baker, that recital comes up. It's pretty funny.
Really?
Yeah. That word, Carte Blanche, doesn't seem to go with my name. I think that's why I think it's funny, because it's such a fancy word.
So, when you're looking at students, like potential students who are coming in to study with you at Manhattan or wherever it may be, like, what are you looking at? Like, for any students who might be listening, what's the criteria that really kind of raises an eyebrow for you?
I remember getting asked this question a long time ago there were some researchers from Yale who interviewed me about some project they were doing. And the answer I said was, I pick up on a vibe, which sounds weird. I think it's just, it's a connection, you know, like typically I can tell by looking in their eyes or the conversation that they have with me, you know, if I enjoy their playing, and you know, there's all that stuff too, but mainly like if I need to pick and choose how many students I'm going to take, I tend to go for the ones that I feel like I have a connection with. So that being said, some of them will play for me ahead of time, you know? And so I do kind of suggest that, for two reasons. I know you when you walk in the room, but also you're more comfortable, it's not you, but the students are more comfortable walking in the room knowing somebody, you know, it's not quite so scary. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's kind of invaluable. So then I already feel like I know them, or I've already decided that I don't want them to be my students, which I probably shouldn't say, but but I think most of the students that I have now, I knew ahead of time, except for a handful. You know, so it's feeling the connection, feeling like I feel like I have a certain feel for my studio that I want, which is like a family type feel.
Right.
When I was at Juilliard, I remember not being friends with very many horn players, and they were a little snobby, and except for a few, like Javier Gandara, my colleague at the Met. He was always very nice to me. But a few others, and I've seen them since, and we've discussed this, so I'm not telling tales out of school, weren't necessarily friendly to me. And I didn't like that, you know, and I wanted like the a family kind of feel at school. So like a vow to myself, you know, if I ever become a teacher, I'm going to make sure that there's like a family feel, you know. Right. And I think I'm, you know, at least encouraging that at Manhattan School. And you know, my studio classes that I've been having this summer have been so awesome because they're all so helpful and encouraging to each other. And yeah, I love it.
Cool. That also kind of harkens back to that vibe of when teachers, they would only take on a few students and they would foster them for a long time. Well, they were basically their protege, you know.
Right.
But you have to have more of a connection than just, I like how you play. I believe that the student really has to respect the teacher, and the teacher has to respect the student also, and be on the same plane. So that's why I think it's really cool that you're kind of looking for, when you say a vibe, it's like, it's totally true. You have to vibe with your teacher. I don't really know Julie Landsman all that well. I mean, I've met her once or twice, but I have a lot of friends who studied with her, and a lot of them have done really, really well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why they do so well, is that they really have gelled with her.
She also is interested in like the family feel and you know, taking care of her students, and they take care of her and help walk her dog, and you know, it's yeah. Very family oriented over there as well.
It's really interesting to me how many great players that are women have been in the Met and have been with Julie and
yeah.
And it's just, I heard in a master class with her, it was more of a panel with her, and how she talked about how when she won the audition with the Met, it was, you know, I mean, basically she made sure that she played so that there was no question that she was going to win the job, you know?
That's right.
And I love that. There have been so many great women players who have come during her tenure and after her tenure. And I just can't help but see like a correlation there, you know?
Yeah. Well, you're right.
The playing and the confidence of person, and anybody who thinks that they can tell the difference between a dude playing and a woman playing is nuts, because two of my teachers were women horn players, and I'll tell you what, they had sounds that were like, I'm still trying to like be able to like that.
You know? Yep. I mean, I've been asked many times before, like, you know, about being a woman musician and isn't that, or women brass player, isn't that weird or whatever, like, but by the time I came along, it wasn't really a thing anymore, you know. It's like there was, Julie was there, and you know, plenty of others, and yeah, I mean, I feel sorry for the people that came before me, that it was such a struggle, you know, but I'm grateful to them that they paved the way, you know, that it wasn't a struggle for me and the people who are coming after me, or at least not as big of a struggle, to put it that way. I know some people still have some struggles.
And guys can be weird. I mean, that's just, I've worked with, I mean, I guess growing up in Vegas also, but I've heard everything, you know. I've heard guys,
yeah,
or can't play loud, or can't play loud. I'm like, are you kidding me? Have you heard her play?
Yeah, right. Well, thank you, Chris.
No, I don't know why I got on that tangent. I'm just like picturing your section, and it's just like such great playing. The music, I've never played like a full opera.
Yeah. You know?
Oh. I mean, in school I did, but it wasn't Wagner or Rosenkavalier with no rehearsal.
Yeah.
I mean, just the suite would be hard enough, but I mean, the entire thing.
Yeah.
So I like to ask this of guests that come on. If it wasn't the horn, what do you think you'd be doing?
Oh, boy. I mean, I guess my other interests are like social work, and my church is involved in a lot of social work. So maybe I would have, you know, like church related social work type things. There was a time when I thought I wanted to be, you're going to laugh, a female boxer.
No way.
Yeah, I was really into boxing for a while. I still like it. I was doing it today. but I'm not, you know, into it as like I was. I was doing, you know, coachings and whatever you call them. I don't even know what you call them, lessons, I guess, with the boxing coach and sparring a little bit. And so it was a short time. I thought I wanted to do something like that, but it was short.
You know, I've always been in boxing also. My dad's from El Salvador.
Oh.
He was heavy into boxing. And growing up in a half Hispanic household, boxing and soccer were like it, you know. I love boxing. I remember my dad taking me to go see Mike Tyson fight.
Oh, wow.
And I remember he saved up so much money. I mean, this is 1988, maybe. And I remember him saying that the tickets were like $300 each. And we were in like the nosebleeds, like so far away. The ring was so small and it was over in like 15 seconds.
Oh, man.
Just thinking that my dad spent so much money on these tickets.
Aww. Like
tiny and it lasted so short. But I still remember it. I mean, it was huge. So, but I've always loved boxing. I have a heavy bag and a speed bag and stuff. And
wow. I'm not that into it, but I mean, when I was going to the boxing gym, I did that stuff, but I don't have it at my house. I do kickboxing videos, you know.
Oh, cool.
At this point.
Cool. Well, maybe that's one of the reasons why you look younger than me.
Oh, you're nice.
Well, so what are your hobbies then? I mean, besides, you know, music or anything like
that? Taking care of my grandkids. That's my favorite hobby. You know, family, I would say. Family is what takes up a big chunk of my time, what I want to take up a big chunk of my time.
Right.
I love reading. That's what I've been doing a lot of lately. Cooking, taking walks, you know, it's fun.
What are some of your favorite things to cook? Just out of curiosity. I just started getting into cooking. And my wife makes fun of me because when we met, I had a really nice kitchen and all this stuff, but I never used it at all. And now I'm cooking all the time and I'm kicking myself for like not doing it throughout my 20s, you know?
Right. Well, growing up in Texas, I ate a lot of Tex-Mex food.
Yes.
And I haven't found a place here that compares, you know, and so I cook Tex-Mex quite a bit. That's my go-to. Every dish I'm thinking of is some kind of Mexican thing.
Do you like the spice or?
Medium.
Okay.
Medium. Yeah.
I'm a wuss.
Are you?
I can't handle it. I don't know what it is.
What do you like to cook? What's your favorite dish?
Oh, I'm on the grill. I love to cook like a ribeye or I'll do chicken or sausage or just stuff that requires me to be on my grill. I usually do the outdoor cooking and my wife does the indoor cooking.
That's, I see.
The meal comes together like that.
Aw, that's nice. We live in a place where we can't grill, so.
Oh, okay. Are you like a high rise or something?
Well, it's a condo, but yeah, so, or townhouses, I guess it's officially. And there are some of the units, like across the street, they have a grill, but we're the kind of unit we live in, we can't grill.
Okay. So, actually, when I was in Vegas, I had the same kind of thing, townhouse where I couldn't grill also. Maybe that's why I wasn't into grilling.
There you go.
So, most of your career, did you play the same setup? Like the same instrument and same mouthpiece or were you like a tinker?
Definitely not a tinker. I still play the same mouthpiece I played since I was in high school.
Oh my goodness. The few people that I know that.
I know, it's very strange. It was Mr. Anders made it for me. He had like a little mouthpiece factory in his garage and it's a bored out Horner 6, and he made me a rim because I play Einsetzen and you know, you just know, oh, you need this and that, a sharper edge here and, you know, whatever. And it's great. And so why change? And then even back then I was playing a con and just love the sound. And, you know, I heard you and Dan, I think, also said in the Boston Brass, Dan Gravoy, in the Boston Brass workshop thing about how, you know, you said that you played on your con when you grew up, and then when you switched to the Yamaha, you still sound like yourself or something like that. Or Dan said, I'm like mixing the two things you guys said. I actually agree with that. But I love the sound of the con, and I've never felt, you know, the want to change. So, maybe I've only owned 3 8Ds in my life. So that's it. I borrowed a Descan horn to play a gig or two, but I don't own one.
You're right, though. I mean, when I was saying you sound like you sound on an instrument, the character is there, but there's definitely a difference in sound, though. I mean, when you're playing an 8D, that it's like the breadth of the tone. It's like the core is like a wider, and it's just so much fun to listen to and to play also.
Did you happen to catch our video, the 8D sound project? We did Sleep.
Yes. You know, I went to school with Eric
Whitaker.
Yeah.
You did? Oh, my goodness.
I did at UNLV in Vegas. It was his last year, the year that I came in. And that's when he started really writing. Like, Tom Leslie is the band director over in UNLV. And he had him writing stuff like Godzilla Eats Las Vegas and Ghost Train and stuff like
that. Oh, my gosh.
These are some of his first tunes, you know?
Wow. So. Yeah, that song is so beautiful.
Yeah. Well, you guys have been amazing.
Well, that was, you know, we're talking about the 8D sound. That it was sort of my idea, I guess. It's like, I thought, like, in this age of, like, everybody, you know, this is all we can do is play virtually. Let's get the sound out there, you know. So, you know, it's just a thought I had, and I shared it with Julie. And, you know, neither one of us know anything about computers, or I don't think we can do what you do, you know. On the daily. So I decided to reach out to Jeff Pilkington and Nathaniel Silberschlag because they play cons and they're awesome. And they know a lot about computers and whatnot. And they just ran with it, you know. And next thing you know, we have this almost 500,000 people listening to this video.
That's amazing.
So more to come. I think we're going to do a couple more.
Oh, good. Oh, that's really good news. Yeah. You know, I have an 8D. No.
Wait, say it again. Oh, you have an 8D. Yeah. I'll remember that.
I'm just happy to listen. It is really kind of a cool thing that's going on. I've been having fun putting out multi-track stuff for quite a few years now. When I'm on the road, I had these like lulls where I'd be on the road, then I come home. And I might be home for 2 weeks, and it's like hard to stay a little bit motivated to stay in shape, go and play shows again. And so that's kind of what I would do, you know, is like give myself a project. I'm going to record something, whatever. But it's so fun to see so many people doing it now, you know, and hearing all these great players and then hearing like players of the quality of you guys doing it. It's just like, wow, man. This is like what an age we live in where all these young people who are in high school or junior high, they're hearing the best of the best putting out stuff all the time. And it's like, it didn't used to be like that. You know, you sit around and wait for the next record to come out or whatever.
That's so, right.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you were kind of one of the trailblazers of that. I mean, I've been watching your videos for years. I told you, I'm a huge fan.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm a huge fan of yours too, if you can tell. Pandemic aside, what are you doing playing wise?
Well, like I said, I'm playing at the Met a little bit. I play a little bit with Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. I've subbed in Jersey Symphony a little bit, you know, a few little like St. Luke's Orchestra, a few little freelance gigs here or there. But it's nice to be able to say no, because it like hits on the night my granddaughter has a concert or something, you know. You know what I mean? Like, whereas before I'd have to tell my granddaughter, sorry, I can't come to your concert because I have to work, you know. Yeah. Now I can see that coming and go, well, I can't say yes to that gig. So it's not that I'm getting that many gigs, but you know, just it's nice to have the option. I've done a few like movie things since I retired, but you know, not that much. It's mainly family and teaching and the doing the chair thing at the Manhattan School, right. Which is time consuming. But I enjoy it. And and you know, taking care of my husband. So which is nice. I mean, for so many years, we were just talking about it today. For so many years, I would leave in the morning and, you know, go to rehearsal, teach in the afternoon, play the show at night, come home, and he'd be asleep. You know? Right. And now we're together all day long. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's great.
What do you find yourselves doing? Are you like binging any stuff?
We've been binging a little.
Okay, what are you watching? I got to know, because me and my wife, we take care of our own stuff during the day, but when nighttime comes, we both meet upstairs on the couch and we're like, okay, you got to watch something. And nowadays there's so many things out, you just kind of like surf. I'll have like had my whole snack before I even started wherever it was that I was supposed to start. I'm like, so what do you watch?
Okay, my newest favorite we just finished is called Dr. Foster.
What's and, that?
It's on Netflix.
Okay.
And Mindhunter we just started. That's pretty good.
Mindhunter.
That's my two recommendations.
What's Dr. Foster about? I'm just curious.
Well, it's about the woman, Dr. Foster, who finds out that her husband's cheating on her. And it's just like, you know, you would think it would just be that's just like that story again. But it's like, you know, it just kind of escalates into this next weird thing happens. And, you know, okay. Oh my gosh, that happened. You know, it's just like, it just keeps going like these weird, weird storylines and still somehow realistic, you know, like, oh, it actually could happen to somebody.
Right.
So check it out.
Check it out. Did you see what's it called, like Little Fires? Like, I want to say it's called like Lots of Little Fires, but I know it's not called Lots of Little Fires because that's a terrible name.
It doesn't sound familiar.
It's really good. Anyway, I don't know.
We also like reality TV.
Oh, me too. Do you guys watch Survivor?
Just not that. We haven't watched Survivor, no. Julie loves Survivor. You guys can bond over that.
That's what I'm going to do, because we didn't bond last time I talked to her. She was in Vegas. They had done their whole thing, and I had just gotten into town, so I didn't get to be part of the symposium. I think it was like a Southwest Horn workshop or something. Anyway, I couldn't be part of it, but I went to a hang that she was at, and we were trying to talk about tequila, but they only had like a really terrible tequila at this party. And she was like, this tequila is no good. And I was like, okay.
But she does like her tequila.
Now I know we can talk about Survivor.
No, we watch Below Deck.
Is that like a Titanic thing?
No. No, it's about people who work on a yacht.
Oh, really?
So you see the workers underneath the yacht, and you see like Johnny Damon, who is an ex-Yankee, he came to be with his family, came to be a guest on the yacht. So you see a little bit of the guests, but mostly it's about the people who are working underneath.
Oh, that's cool. That's kind of like a yacht version of Downton Abbey.
I haven't seen Downton Abbey.
Oh my goodness. Okay. If you haven't seen, sorry for those who are listening, this is true.
We're not talking about music anymore.
If you haven't seen Downton Abbey, you need to start watching Downton. You need to.
Okay. Put that on my list.
Yeah. It's a good one. I want to thank you so much for hanging out with me and talking. It's really, really cool to hear your background and hear what you've done and get to know you as a person.
Likewise.
I'll catch you guys later, and I'll catch you later. Thanks so much.
Bye.